It's a disorder with no cure or uniform treatment. Its causes have been the source of a heated debate, and it's been showing up in an alarming number of children. Yes. This week's Please Explain is all about autism, and joining me now is Dr. Robert Schultz, a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Center of Autism Research. We're also joined by Dr. Kathy Pratt, the chair of the board of directors of the Autism Society of America. And as always, we invite your calls and questions on autism at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert, is there a simple description of autism?
Well, the current conceptualization suggests that there's three areas of difficulties for kids with autism. What most people consider primary is difficulties with social interactions, forming friendships, you know, understanding the motives and intentions of other people. But there's also early developmental problems with language and communication. And then the third area would be difficulties with resistance to change. Kids with autism don't like change. They often engage in repetitive movements and repetitive activities. So there's no simple, single description. We think of it as a kind of a conglomeration of behavioral signs that describe the disorder.
Kathy, would I recognize that a child was autistic at first sight?
You would if the child had a more significant disability. For some of those individuals, the primary area of difficulty is going to be social challenges. And so that may be a little bit more difficult to detect at first. But I think what is important for folks to understand is that autism is a spectrum disorder, and that means that every individual is going to be different. And while you can make generalized statements that we know that it's a neurological disorder, we know that these kids have, or these individuals have, social and communication difficulties and restricted activities that they participate in, how they manifest those skills is going to be very different.
Well, how is that any different from any other child? All children have certain things in common, but they all, at a very early age, start becoming very distinctively themselves.
Right. That's a really good question. And I think, children do indeed develop their own personalities. But let me give you an example of this when I mean spectrum. You have some individuals with autism who have significant mental retardation, and then you have individuals who have very high cognitive levels and may be gifted. You have some individuals who, all of them will have social difficulties. Some may be withdrawn, and then some may really want to engage in social skills but not know how to. And I think what makes this different from typical children is that these are children who are kind of on the exceptional margins of those characteristics.
Also, some of them talk, some of them are echolalic,
right.
And then some cannot talk
right.
pretty much ever through all throughout their lives.
Right.
And it's not always connected to intelligence. There are all so many other neurological factors.
Right, correct.
So, Robert, do brain scans of autistic children look similar to any other brain disorders we know of?
Not to any other brain disorders.
I mean, is it connected? Do we see it manifest itself in the areas of the brain that deal with language, for example?
We do. So you have to distinguish between looking at an individual child's brain scan and looking at the kind of the average child with autism versus the average typically developing kid. When we get groups of data and look at averages, we begin to see interesting differences in the brain. And those differences are in parts of the brain that are responsible for those functions that kids have a hard time with, kids with autism. So it's not only the language areas, but it's the social areas, the social brain. Seems to be in particular quite different in kids with autism.
There were some researchers from Italy who came up with the mirror neurons, which mm-hmm. excited a lot of people. Those are that's the part of the nervous system where we imitate others, and it was suggested that perhaps there's either a deficiency of mirror neurons or no mirror neurons in children who are autistic.
So the mirror neuron hypothesis is a really exciting one. The basic idea is that when you see something else, you replicate it. When you see someone else acting, you may mirror that activity at a very low level in your own brain, and that mirroring activity helps you understand what you see. So if I see someone who's emotionally upset, I may have some sort of mirroring kind of empathy response. It may not be strong enough to actually experience it consciously, but it enables me to put myself in that other person's shoes to understand what they're thinking and feeling.
And that doesn't seem to happen with autistic children?
We know behaviorally they have a really hard time with that. The work with imaging to see whether those neurons in the brain are really different in kids with autism is really just beginning, but there clearly is some evidence that kids with autism have an under kind of responsive mirror neuron system to social events.
Don't some autistic children have elevated levels of serotonin in their bloodstream as well?
So it's one of the oldest and best replicated findings is that kids have hyposerotonemia, low levels of serotonin in the blood system. But we don't really know what that means for brain mechanisms. It's kind of a puzzle.
Kathy, how old are most children when they're first diagnosed with autism?
Well, it depends on the degree of autism, but I think, and maybe Dr. Schultz knows this better than I do, but my understanding of it, hearing the latest statistics, is that oftentimes it's not until 60 months or so. The hope is, the desire is, the goal is to be able to identify these children earlier, because we know that early intervention is really critical. But I think even today, as sophisticated as we are about our knowledge of autism, families still find that when they go to physicians, their family doctor, their pediatrician, or if their child is in child care or something, that oftentimes people will just still say to them, you know, don't worry, your child will grow out of this, you know, it's just normal, this is your first child, you're being overly sensitive. And so it takes a time, and sometimes parents will talk about having gone to numerous professionals before they get an accurate diagnosis for their son or daughter.
When you said, did you say 60 or 16 months?
60 months.
So that's 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that many parents become concerned when the kid is about a year and a half old.
Right.
There's a big gap between a year and a half and 5 years.
Well, I think that that's one of the concerns for many of us is that what is available for families if they are close to a research hospital or if they're close to an organization that does autism services or if they're close to an organization or involved in an agency that understands autism, they probably get an earlier diagnosis. But unfortunately, many families aren't in those situations, and so the struggle is always, and the thing, and what the Autism Society of America continues to strive for is, how do we make those services that are available for individuals who are kind of have more access to resources, how do we make those equally available to all, regardless of where they live or what their income level is?
Robert, the statistics that are generally cited are kind of shocking. 15 years ago, one out of every 1,000 births might have been diagnosed as autistic. Now it's one in 165 or so. 300,000 children age 10 or younger in the United States alone, five times more common than Down syndrome, three times as common as juvenile diabetes. And many people are talking about an epidemic. Do you think there is an epidemic?
Well, clearly it's a very common disorder. We didn't appreciate that 20 years ago. We now do. The real question is whether the rates have changed, and there's some question about that. One of the reasons why the rates might be going up, the detection rates, but the real rate might not, is simply greater awareness amongst physicians and psychologists and psychiatrists.
That much greater, 1,000 as opposed to 166? That seems to me like that many people must have been totally blind in the past, or something else must be going on.
Well, the other thing that's going on is the definition has not remained stable across time. So it's really hard to compare base rates when how we define the disorder has also changed. So there has been a broadening of the definition. So we are appreciating the milder cases, we think, at a much higher rate than we used to. This doesn't discount the possibility that there is a real increase, but most scientists are skeptical of the fact that there's a real increase, and we're waiting to find, you know, solid evidence. The easier explanation, the more obvious explanation, is that we're just detecting it at a higher rate.
Well, many parents are convinced that it is the result of the MMR vaccinations. which occur around 18 months, around the same time that many children seem to start acting as though they were autistic. And there's a big debate over whether it's possible that it could be connected to the vaccinations. So led some parents to not have their kids vaccinated or to insist on having the MMR vaccinations broken up into three separate shots.
So it's clear that this has caused a lot of concern and a lot of debate. It depends on what community you talk to as to how much of a debate there is. In the scientific community, there really isn't much debate. There have been more than a dozen studies looking at kids who've had the MMR vaccination and those who haven't, and looking at the base rates of autism, and they don't find any difference. Parents, on the other hand, oftentimes, you know, see the onset of the symptoms around the time of the vaccination, and you know, we'll put two and two together. The large-scale studies suggest that if there is a role for vaccination, it really isn't a prominent role. It doesn't seem to be affecting many kids. It's always hard to say it doesn't affect any child, but from the group studies, it doesn't appear to be a place where we should be devoting a lot of new resources to investigating.
Kathy Pratt, does the Autism Society of America feel the same?
You know, I think what's very difficult, and I'm a practitioner at the same time as being an educator, at the same time as being chair of the board, is what's very hard is when you're standing in front of a room full of parents and you ask them, you know, when did your child develop autism, and do you think there's a possibility that there's a link between the onset of autism and the vaccination? And you'll see a lot of parents raise their hand. I think the approach that we've taken is that concern still tells us that we need to be cautious. And I have to tell you, as long as I've been involved in this, I actually don't know that, and I could be wrong, but I have not heard anyone say to family members, don't vaccinate your child. I think it's always been about how you vaccinate children safely. I think the other piece of this is that, in my mind, the field is really turning to looking at autism as being a link between a genetic predisposition and also and then having an environmental trigger.
So in other words, if the trigger is not there, a child might not become autistic?
But it's looked at along with some of the other immune-related disorders. I was just talking to a colleague about the fact that her son has Crohn's disease. Well, as people are looking at Crohn's disease, they're looking at the same thing as genetic predisposition and environmental triggers, and all of these being somewhat related to immune-related disorders. So I think, you know, we don't know what's causing it, and I would hope that that our research community would keep their mind open to all possibilities.
Well, a recent study from California found that autism rates were highest for children whose mothers lived the closest to the fields where organochlorine pesticides were being used.
Mm-hmm.
So would that suggest that perhaps the organochlorine pesticides and maybe other environmental things would have triggered the genetic predisposition?
Possibly, and that is what people are looking at.
And Robert, what's your feeling on that?
Well, clearly there's non-genetic, you know, sources of influence, and this is a very, you know, promising, you know, new study. We would want to replicate it, but you know, quite possibly it's true.
Now, Crohn's disease is gastrointestinal, and I've heard people say that autism has a gut component as well.
Mm-hmm.
Has much research been done in that area?
Robert, I'm going to let you answer that because I don't. I know that there are many families who notice that amongst their sons and daughters that they have gastrointestinal difficulties,
and that's why some of them are put on special diets.
Right, and as someone who works in the field of children who have behavioral challenges, I know that oftentimes there is also a medical component to their behavior. So it's one of those things that being related to the immune-related disorders is something that folks are looking at.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with our listeners' calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And my guests are Dr. Kathy Pratt, Chair of the Board of Directors of the Autism Society of America, and Dr. Robert Schultz, a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Center of Autism Research. Stay with us. Thank you. We're back with Drs. Robert Schultz and Kathy Pratt talking about autism and taking your calls at 212-2. I've suddenly forgot our phone number. Isn't that wild? 212-333-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Let's go to our first caller, Nancy from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I both appreciate and love WNYC. My son Andrew's 8, and he has autism. And as you mentioned, it's a spectrum disorder, but it's also a spectrum disorder in how you treat it. Mm-hmm. Autism is the only illness that I know of in my lifetime where they approach it really almost exclusively from a behavioral analysis approach. And that behavioral modification.
Well, that's not totally true, is it? Because there are competing theories as to how to treat it as well. There's the ABA, the behavioral analysis approach, and then there's the Greenspan approach, which involves play and other things. And there are a number of other competing approaches as well.
I agree, and I'm kind of getting to those. In the educational arena, it seems to be almost all ABA, and I'm actually a big supporter of the Sunrise, which looks to the child to lead the parent into their world so that they can pull the child back into theirs. So it's a real focus in sharing and lead of the child. But the point I'm calling about as far as illness is I 100% believe my son's autism is physiologically based. And it has manifestations really in the gastrointestinal area. And I don't know in the neurological area because I'm certainly not a researcher. But if you don't believe that autism is biologically based, you can come over with pizza and chocolate for my son and then stick around to clean up the mess like any other allergic reaction or sensitivity reaction. He can't sleep. He has loose stools, he becomes hyperactive and more self-stimulatory.
And this is not uncommon. A lot of autistic children supposedly have allergies and get hyperactive if they eat certain foods, often carbohydrates. Do we have any idea of why?
The prevailing theory is just that how these children are able to process foods and so basically what happens is that they're put on special diets to keep them away from some of these foods that they seem to have tremendous difficulty with processing. I think, you know, what's very hard, and I appreciate the caller's comment, I think what's very hard is that we are just really, in my mind, at the beginning of understanding what autism is and what causes it. And I think what's incredibly hard for families is to be able to kind of negotiate through the maze of the different treatment approaches. And I know that in every aspect of science, whether it's educational, behavioral, medical, genetic, whatever it is, there is such a heavy focus on making sure that we are utilizing and acknowledging evidence-based practices and strategies. And my sense of it is, I've been in the field of autism for over 30 years, my sense of it is that this increase happens so dramatically that oftentimes autism research has been underfunded, and all of a sudden we have this awareness that this disability is happening, and it's happening pretty often, it's pretty prevalent. And so everyone is running now to try to figure out, okay, what's causing this to happen? And for family members, it's very difficult because you have a lot of practitioners out there who are promising outcomes, promising strategies that maybe don't have the research behind it. And I think I'm sure that for Dr. Schultz as well for myself, that's a frustration is we want to make sure that when families use their precious resources, that they're doing so in a manner using strategies and practices that we know are evidence-based. But at this point, I think that with anything in the field of autism, there is controversy.
And there's been, it's very expensive for parents, isn't it?
They
often have to sue boards of education to get special education for their kids. They have to fight insurance companies to get special medication and treatment for the kids. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, there's underfunding. You would think that that would have changed in recent years with all of the attention paid to autism. Or are people confused? Did a movie like The Rain Man do more damage than good, as some parents have told me? What do you think, Dr. Schultz?
Oh, I don't think it's done more damage than good. I mean, it is an accurate portrayal of some people on the spectrum. I mean, if it oversimplifies the disorder or pigeonholes people into that particular manifestation of autism, then perhaps it has.
Well, it's led a lot of people to think that all autistic people are savants.
Sometimes that's misunderstood, yes. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things about funding is that funding has gone up in recent years. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we do need to applaud the efforts of organizations like Autism Speaks, who have really, gotten into the fray and provided a lot of valuable resources to researchers, as well as the NIMH. They've increased the amount of funding quite a bit in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. This is from Sheila from Manhattan. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Leonard. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm calling to find out if your guests would say something about Asperger's, which is often not diagnosed until adulthood, if then.
This is high-functioning autism.
How is it currently defined and treated with adults?
Kathy?
Yeah,
Kathy?
Do you want me to take that
sure.
question? I think one of the challenges that we have, and again, I can just speak in terms of some of the issues that I see in my state. You're right, is that many of these individuals were not diagnosed until adults, because, or at least the current generation, because Asperger's was not a diagnosis that we acknowledged in the United States until the 90s. So I know that for me, that I get calls from adults with Asperger's or from adult service agencies with individuals who maybe were diagnosed with either mental health issues or behavioral issues, and now there's an understanding that, yes, indeed, this person does have Asperger's. I think Asperger's, in my mind, sometimes, and I work with individuals across the spectrum, sometimes I think it's very challenging for folks to understand and respond to the needs of folks with Asperger's. And the reason that I'm saying that is that because they are so articulate in so many ways, oftentimes we have to do a lot of awareness with the community to say, yes, this individual may have an IQ of 160, but they still have challenges in certain areas. And they're not being willful or refusing to do things. It's just that they really do have these significant challenges. So I think there has to be a lot of awareness. And because I work in the adult service arena also, I'm very sensitive to the fact that we have folks who are going on to higher education, and higher education is not prepared to support them, that we have individuals who are going into employment situations, and because people don't understand their behaviors are often struggling in those employment situations.
You want to add anything, Dr. Schultz?
Well, the only thing I would add is oftentimes those who have milder manifestations of the spectrum are diagnosed later. The kids who present earliest usually have the more severe manifestations. So in addition to the fact that Asperger's wasn't recognized officially until 1994, it is harder to detect, and I think that was part of the caller's point.
Joe from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I have a daughter. I did not allow the doctors to administer the vaccines two or three at a time. I, in fact, protested and got them to administer single-dose type vaccines, not multiple dose, which means that from one vial you can give the same vaccine to multiple children. That was the first thing because of the type of preservative in the vaccines. And second of all, when I was challenged by the doctor, it inevitably happens, I said to the doctor point blank, I said, Doc, if you have a fund in Washington that's there to pay for any kind of ill effect, based on the vaccines, as a consequence of a vaccine, if you give out three vaccines at once, how do you know which vaccine caused the problem in the first place?
So let's follow up on this, doctors. Why are the three vaccines bunched together, the MMR vaccines, measles, mumps, and rubella? Is it simply a matter of economics? And why give a rubella vaccine anyway? That's German measles. I remember I had German measles when I was a kid. It was It lasted one day. It was the mildest illness I had when I was a kid.
I'm sorry, but I can't speak to the issue of why pediatricians give all three of them at once. Mm-hmm. I know that the overall dose of the vaccine itself is small compared to other things that have been given in the past.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, you want to add to that?
I don't. I'm not a physician either. But, you know, I'm sure I can tell you what families say is that they just think that it's probably more, their perception is that it's more cost effective. So.
Cost effective. If one in 166 children is coming down with a condition, a neurological condition that may be linked to this, perhaps we should stop thinking in those terms. They have taken thimerosal out of the vaccine. That was the mercury, and autism rates have continued at a pretty high level. So I guess that argument is no longer applicable. But but as you said, there are all sorts of reasons that this can be triggered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's go to another another call. Mitch from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, Leonard, you always have a great show. I have a suggestion. In order to target possibly what's causing this, and following the advice of Sigmund Freud, who said, first you eliminate the physiological, and that is to do a blood panel on a child before they get vaccines.
Well, how would you know whether somebody even had a tendency toward autism?
No, it's
just
not
about looking at the blood.
What I'm saying, as a protocol, you do a blood panel. You draw a little blood, then you know what the blood was before. Then, when you give the vaccine, and I suggest that you do it in not bunching them up, but then afterward, you do another blood draw. And if there's a change, then at least you can target.
Uh-huh. What do you think about that? Would that even be a reasonable approach?
I mean, I think you would have to ask an immunologist truthfully whether that's a reasonable approach. I would start with the data, and there are large-scale studies looking at hundreds of thousands of kids with and without MMR vaccination, and the rates of autism don't differ. So if the rates don't differ, that would be a very expensive proposition to dig deeper with that kind of biological assay.
Helda from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a social worker, and I work with a very wonderful early intervention program in Manhattan. And I'd just like to point out that we do a number of evaluations on young children and make diagnoses for kids who are as young as 18 months and sometimes younger with a diagnosis of PDD or autism.
Now, PDD is the mildest form.
There's a spectrum, so yes. But the point is that these young children do exhibit enough symptoms that a diagnosis can be made, which then will allow for services through the early intervention program to take place. And I think that's an important factor because parents will call worried about specific symptoms that, in fact, may lead to a diagnosis. So they're pretty much aware of what's going on.
Well, of course,
pediatricians now are also required to do an assessment at different stages before the child is two so that we are making reliable diagnoses well before the age of five.
And early intervention, the federal program, lasts until a child is three. The both of you, Drs. Schultz and Pratt, suggested that the earlier you catch this, the better it is. What happens? If there is good early intervention, does the brain rewire?
So studies are ongoing right now exactly about that, but we don't know. We know that the brain, learning is a type of rewiring. So the brain is always rewiring. And if the behaviors are improving as a result of intervention, at some level, it's obvious that the brain is rewiring. But the more interesting questions are, under what conditions does it rewire? Can we understand how it rewires so we can facilitate that rewiring, so we can modify how we intervene?
Years ago, I spoke to Temple Grandin, who felt that her brain was continuing to rewire, that even in her late 50s, she saw differences in the way that she related to things. And she felt that actually the brains of autistic people maybe are more active in that way than the brains of other people.
Hmm.
I think that's a really good point, and I think and I've known Temple for many years, and I think and she has continued to grow and really is a tremendous woman today. But I think what I don't want to give the illusion of ever is that we do early intervention and then we drop the ball, because we also see individuals who, when they hit secondary programs, middle school and high school or into college, that they begin to struggle again with something. So I think we talk about early intervention, but I think it has to be early, and earlier the better, but then continual support and continual oversight and continual education.
Well, how likely is it that somebody who is given good early intervention will eventually wind up mainstreamed?
It depends on the skills that the individual comes to the early intervention program with, but we do see a number of individuals who are indeed mainstreamed in regular education settings across the country.
And then they just seem like typical children from then on?
My sense of it is that at least the majority of the folks that I work at, you see some residual skills, and you see where they may start having some challenges again when they start hitting middle school or when they start approaching college.
I want to thank the two of you so much for talking with us today on Please Explain. We've been talking about autism with Dr. Kathy Pratt, the chair of the board of directors of the Autism Society of America, and with Dr. Robert Schultz, a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have put links to a number of different organizations on our show page at wnyc.org. Again, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You.